Hi, I'm Gordon Lamphere, and welcome to the Real Finds Podcast, where we have real conversations with key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers who are shaping the real estate industry and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we'll be speaking with Megan Gluth. Megan is the owner and CEO of Catalint Solutions, Inc., and is a voice in the manufacturing industry for pragmatic leadership, human-centered capitalism, and supply chain resilience. On the podcast, we take a deep dive into Megan's path from below the poverty line to CEO. We look at the power of American capitalism and the uncertain state of American manufacturing and its supply chains. Most of all, we dive into what business leaders need to do to future-proof their businesses. If you're interested in the onshoring movement and manufacturing leadership, today's podcast is well worth a listen. Megan, thanks for hopping on the podcast today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Gordon.
So what got you into the world of corporate life? Because I know I always have Iowa near and dear to my heart, as my mother is an Iowan.
I actually started as a lawyer. Before that, I was just a small town Iowa kid who didn't really know, frankly, what I wanted to be. I grew up below the poverty line, though, and I knew that I didn't want to do that, right? So it's funny because a lot of people set goals in their lives for things that are maybe based on passion or things like that. And I don't ever know if I knew what that was. I liked a lot of things. I liked learning. I liked building things. I liked creating things. I liked being a part of a team. I liked a lot of things that maybe didn't necessarily translate into career, standard career conversations. But I also knew that I wanted to have a sense of self-driven and self sort of fulfilling prophecy a little bit. And so I made my way in the world, and that's a super long story, maybe for this podcast, maybe for not, but ultimately I went to law school and I became an attorney. And I started at a firm where we were advising family offices and closely held businesses and doing sort of advanced estate planning for larger net worth individuals. And I got to see kind of behind the curtain of a lot of how businesses are created and what drives people and what it takes to create, maintain, grow, scale businesses that, while they may be closely held, certainly didn't end up being small. And I came to this company that I now own originally as its first general counsel. And that's how I got started here. Fell in love with the business, loved what we were doing. Quickly, I got promoted to be the president and then the CEO of the company. And then after some time, my predecessor was at a stage of his career where he was getting ready to retire and sell. And I was sort of coming up and I said to him, if I can figure out how to finance this, can I buy this business from you? And that's exactly what happened. It's a crazy story and a crazy journey, but that's how I ended up here.
So how are businesses created? I know you mentioned that. I know there's a lot of our listeners who are in the real estate world, but many of them are business owners as well. Mm-hmm. How does that process play out?
I think the real estate world and the business world are inherently the same thing, because I think all businesses are started by somebody saying, I want to make something bigger than what is here, right? So this thing that you see in front of you, maybe it's an idea, maybe it's somebody's vision, maybe it's somebody's solution to a problem, maybe it's simply a skill they have that they'd like to market and monetize, or it could be simple as something like a duplex on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, right? Like there's all sorts of things where a person looks at that and says, what this is here in front of me could be something bigger. And it could be something that creates something bigger than what is here right now. And it becomes its own thing and its own idea and its own enterprise. And I think that's how a business is ultimately created from an ideological standpoint. Obviously, as an attorney, I tell you all the nuances of how that actually happens. But at its core, business, particularly business in America, is the seed of someone's entrepreneurial spirit, looking at something that doesn't exist and wanting to create something that does with their mark on it.
So putting our mark on this conversation, one of the things that everyone's talking about in the business world, and I know I've got clients, particularly on the industrial side, worried about kind of where we're seeing with global supply chains. And your business is very tied into global supply chains, from what I understand. So how are you kind of
seeing the complexities of global trade play out, and how are you addressing that?
So I have to be honest and say that I'm addressing that in a sort of one day at a time philosophy, because I think that's all really any of us can do right now. This is not a knock on the administration or any policymakers at all. That's not what I do, and it's not. But it is a fact right now that we are trying to run a business in an environment that lacks steady and durable and long-term guidance on what we should be doing. And so we're all turning on the news and saying, okay, what is it today? And we don't really know. That presents an interesting challenge for supply chain and for business in general. But my business is not only supply chain, and in particular, global supply chain. We procure from all over the world raw materials used by companies in America to make things. Some of my customers make infant formula. Some of my customers make paint. Some of my customers make downhole oil drilling fluids. Some of my customers make soft drinks. All of those things that are made here in the United States have ingredients that go into their creation. Part of my business is procuring those from all over the world, bringing them to the United States, and giving them in the doses that are needed to these customers for these manufacturing sites. The other part of my business is actually manufacturing. I have a plant in Chicago where we make those very things under other people's labels. It's called contract manufacturing, for anybody who's not familiar. And so I see the supply chain in sort of a dual way, not only as a supplier, but also as a user of these things, both from the perspective of the user, an American company who's seeking to make things in the US, and from the perspective of a supplier seeking to gather things from a global supply chain and put them then back out into the supply chain. We are all operating right now in a season of really dramatic uncertainty. And this is caused by the fact that we have been told there would be tariffs, then the tariffs stopped. We have been told that there are conversations going on, and then we're told that they're not going well and they're going to break apart. And the stock market is not the economy, but it is for us a barometer of what's happening in the minds of American business people, right? What you see in terms of that sort of erratic, questionable, what's really happening is, I think, governed by two things. We can't forecast. Things are uncertain. We don't know what's coming next. And we still have in us a fundamental belief that what we do is valuable and good, and there is a future and a potential goodness coming for us here. And we desire to continue to do that entrepreneurial spirit, to grow our businesses, to do what the president and the administration is asking us to do, which is to invest in our country and grow. But we're hampered by the fact that we don't have clear policy guidance, so we can't forecast. And not to get too technical, we're also living in an interest rate environment, which makes it sort of not attractive to want to make large capital investments in the very things that we're supposed to be incentivized to do. So it's a very, very tricky environment in which to run a business. That's why I say it's sort of one week at a time.
Can you talk a little bit more about how interest rates have affected you guys? Because I think overwhelmingly, we see it every day on the commercial real estate side. But beyond that, I think it's also a huge factor for businesses as well. And I don't think the real estate community talks enough about it.
No, I think when the real estate community talks about it, everybody thinks they're just talking about mortgage interest rates.
Exactly.
And that's true, right? There's certainly an element of that there. And I don't mean to belittle that or degrade that. And the retort to that is always, well, you guys got used to super low interest rates and it's never coming back. And when I bought my house in the 80s, it was 16%. Yes. I get the joke. But the truth of the matter is, in order to make things affordable for American families, a mortgage rate that is affordable is important if you want to incentivize homeownership, particularly in this inflation environment. And this inflation environment is further impacted by the fact that when we're bringing in goods from all over the world, or when American companies see that their competition from outside the world is coming in more expensive, the price of things goes up, right? And so mortgage rates do become incidentally relevant. From a business investment perspective, the higher the interest rate is to borrow money to do capital improvements, to build a new plant. Let's talk about that in its most, basic form. This is what we're supposed to be doing here, right? Building more things in America. if the interest rate for that money is high, and I'm already concerned about how long it will take for me to get a return on that investment that I'm making or supposed to be making, and I'm living in a very uncertain environment in terms of being able to forecast revenue projections or profit projections, and now you're telling me that interest rates are maybe not going down and possibly going up, my incentive to do that improvement, to make that investment, is not high. Now, I understand that the argument is we raised interest rates to sort of decrease some of that sort of runaway spending. But you have to understand that that spending has to incur in order to make the things in the United States you want to make. And if you don't, you're just placing tariffs on goods coming in from outside of the United States, which makes everything expensive. And I hope I'm being clear in the way I talk. You have this inflation, interest rates, chicken and the egg story. You never really get ahead of the problem.
So how do we end up getting ahead of the problem for businesses? Because I know you've done a lot on the lobbying side. Mm-hmm. What do you think are some of the steps that policymakers can generally look at to try to move steps forward beyond just creating some sort of a game board that's not constantly moving? I know that's probably number one, and I think we've covered that. And I think anybody who's got any business sense in the world who's listening to the podcast will agree with us. But what else can we do to try to move industrial business forward?
Sure, I'm going to speak in really pragmatic ways, and then no one will listen, right? But the answers are actually simpler than we make it. The first thing we need to do from a policy perspective, and I will say this when I'm in DC, is whatever side of the fence you're on, whether you're wearing a blue jersey or a red jersey or no jersey at all, you have to stop being extreme. You have to stop being on either side, like polar ends of the spectrum. Because the truth of the matter is, like most things in life, there's very few black and white things. Most things are gray. So it is true that many American families cannot afford life right now, and things are getting more expensive. The answer to that is not simply because, and again, this is sort of a canned thing, it's not because the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer and there's corporate greed and all of that kind of stuff. Yes, that sort of exists. It's always going to exist. But I think most Americans, frankly, don't understand the difference between gross profit and net profit, or even revenue and profit. And I think some basic economics lessons would be helpful before we troll that corporate greed energy out into the world. You cannot use policy to force increased wages. You may want to do that, and there may be policy reasons to do that. But if you are going to force somebody who owns a fast food restaurant to pay someone $25 or $30 an hour, the price of a gallon of milk will go up. These are economic, fundamental economic principles. We are using a cure in many cases that is causing the sickness. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't raise wages, but what I am saying is if you tell me as a business owner, I have to pay everybody now more, I'm going to raise my prices to cover that. I just am. That is what's going to happen. And so then inflation is going to go up. So then perhaps the policy consideration is a question of what is an acceptable amount of inflation? What are we willing to deal with? Because I don't know if we can say everybody is now forced to a basic minimum wage at this level, but we're only going to allow 2% inflation or 3% inflation in order to cover that. I'm not sure that that makes good sense. When we calculated and set our targets for what inflation should be, were we doing that in an environment where we were using the government to tell business owners what they must pay employees? We removed sort of the free market economy from that equation, from the labor market. What happened to an employee picking where to go to work based on how much money they could make, whether they could do better? Like some of those things left. And so as a result, you have to say, okay, fine. If this is what we choose to do as a country, if this is what we choose to do, then we have to set policy. We have to reconfigure what's acceptable to us in terms of inflation rates. The second thing I think we have to do is we have to understand that there's never going to be a situation where a business like mine is going to go ahead and absorb all of those rising inflationary costs and not seek to raise my prices. It's not going to happen. I'm not running a nonprofit, Gordon. I need to make money. From my gross profit is how I pay my employees. From my net profit is how I make those additional investments that on the other side of the policy fence, I'm being asked and incentivized to make. And so in order to really solve this, we have to go back to the drawing board and we have to say, all right, are some of the tropes we're throwing out into the public space true? Is it true that we should be paying people $25 an hour minimum in the state of California and really only expecting a 3% inflationary rate? Is that possible? Is our math good? Okay. And if we agree that 3% maybe is not realistic and that the new normal is maybe a little bit higher, could we then say that perhaps in order to incentivize continued growth and the return of some of that net profit I was talking about, continued investment, continued capital expenditure, continued capital growth, we need an interest rate environment that isn't always driving towards a 3% inflation rate? And these are complicated conversations. They're boring. They're not sexy for the news. There's not a good soundbite. But that's one basic thing that needs to be done. We need to go back and revisit our assumptions. And we need to revisit what we're telling the American people about what they can expect based on some of these policy objectives we have.
Yeah, I think that's a very tough, dry, and important conversation that we have to have. I know generally in the real estate world, we have conversations when people's rent comes up, be it, you know, a yearly or a 5-year or a 10-year rent. And we'll say something like, hey, you know, we're going to see, you know, 3 or 4% annual increases. And people go, oh, how is that possible? Blah, blah, blah. And we're like, it's inflation. Like, yes. We're not even trying to make more money. We're just trying to maintain the status quo, and asking anybody to take a hit is just not fair. But then at the same time, having that honest conversation where we shouldn't ever be living in an environment where there's zero inflation, because then there's zero growth, right?
That's right.
We have to find that balance. In terms of finding kind of balance, one of the other things that I think is interesting that we've seen, or I've seen at least on a lot of your content, is you talk a lot about like embracing like a human-centered capitalism. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, like, how do you define that, and kind of how can we get to a more inclusive work culture?
For sure. The first thing I tell people when I talk about human-centered capitalism, and it is the way sort of I define my approach to the world, is that number one, the capitalism piece is important. I am an unapologetic capitalist. And I run a for-profit corporation, and we should stop being ashamed of that. We entered a time recently where we were talking about making money like it was a bad thing. We had a CEO out in the Seattle area where I live, who said at his company, everybody, including the CEO, everybody was going to make the same amount of money, right? And we now look back and we see that, you know, I'm not going to name that company or whatever, but that doesn't work, because what you remove there is the spirit of like people who want to build and create and drive the things that drive them. When you take away their incentives, when you take away the pellets from the mouse in the mouse isn't going to run in the maze anymore. And I'm not, somebody will come back and say, humans aren't mice, we're, you know, people and whatever. Like, I get it. I get that. But we are an incentive driven species. We are. And so I'm an unapologetic capitalist. And I think the first part of doing that is to, as a business owner, no matter how small your business is, or even just as a human within your own self-worth, you get to claim and own the fact that you want to make money and you want to be somebody who builds something and increases your own sense of wealth and the wealth of your company. There's nothing wrong with that. The second portion of that is recognizing the very real truth that if you're truly a builder and you truly want to create, you need and you want more satisfaction than money can provide. You have to create an environment that even you're working in that feels good. And when I say good, I mean the kind of environment where you're proud of the fact that everybody that works with you, including yourself, is treated like a human being worthy of dignity and respect and their own sort of self autonomy. When people feel that way and they know that you're genuine in that, because I am, and a lot of people like me are, they want to stay and be a part of that. because they feel valued, they feel respected, and back to the capitalism piece, they feel rewarded. And so what I'm doing is I'm saying, I'm looking at people who work for me, and I'm taking very pragmatic steps. In my business, for example, I'm not interested in your resume when you apply for a job here. I really don't care where you went to school. If you went to Harvard, that's great. I'm sure you're going to tell me about it every day you're here. And that probably means you won't fit in here because we're not doing that here. Do you know what I mean? Like, but no knock on my Harvard friends. But the truth of the matter is, I'm not super interested in that. I ask questions when I finally meet somebody. How old were you when you got your first job? What was it? Have you ever had a paper route? Did you mow lawns for money when you were a kid? What excites you? What drives you? Because when I know the answer to those things, I know whether that employee has the skills I can't teach. I can teach anybody how to sell chemicals or how to work in finance or any of that stuff. But the skills I can't teach are drive, ambition, loyalty, honesty, integrity. And I'll just know. I'll know by the answers to those questions who they are. I also know then whether they're going to be happy here and whether they're going to be the kind of person that wants to roll up their sleeves and kick in with a team and achieve something great. Because people who want to do great things love working with other people who want to do great things. At our company, well over 50% of the people who work here have been here for 10 years plus. They like being a part of this team. They're treated well. They're not paid more than my competition. I live in Seattle. You could probably leave here and go to a major corporation and get stock options. You know what I mean? Like it's not like that. But I create a culture where the fact that you are somebody who works hard and wants to do well matters. And you get to take bigger bites of the apple and you get to be a part of something. And I have people here doing that who have never been to college, and it's irrelevant to me.
Yeah, we had a guest on last year who talked about this. And I think one of the biggest mentality issues that I have with the idea of, you know, equal pay across the board is what you end up doing is you end up hurting the folks that are really trying the hardest and really adding the most value.
Yes.
And those are the folks that you want to reward. That doesn't mean that, like, you know, maybe your property manager on a lower level or your janitor or maybe that they don't deserve more money, but then pay them and pay the person who's not working as hard or not doing as good a job less. And if we try to create companies around ideas of like everyone's equal, what ends up happening is you just have a ton of slackers and then you just have all those hard workers are carrying the weight for everyone else. And that could be the person who's low on the totem pole or that could be someone high on the totem pole. But unless we, you know, find some sense of rewarding and incentivizing those who are adding value, it's a real dystopia. So trying to avoid kind of potential dystopias, how do you go about empowering others in your business and empowering people who are adding value? Because I know that's something that everyone wants to do, and I think you guys have done it very well. So what would be, you know, a couple tidbits of advice that some executive who's listening to this podcast can apply?
I think that leaving the model of everything has to be equal and everything has to be like matrixed out is the best thing you can do. I tie a lot of performance and pay to incentives. And so particularly in across all levels, I always tell people that the people who work for me are typically the people who, again, back to my earlier statement, they had paper routes, they mowed lawns for a living, and then they were the people who described college group project time as their worst nightmare, right? Because they were the people that ended up doing a lot of work. I create a lot of opportunities for those people to share ideas, to experiment with their ideas. A lot of times an incentive for someone can be as simple as saying, at this place, I'm able to go ahead and run out an idea I have, and I'm not fired if I screw it up, right? A lot of people want an environment to experiment and to stretch and to grow, and you would be well served to give people like that opportunity, because that's what they want, and if they know they can do it with you, they'll stay. They'll often stay to be allowed to be the head of a project that they're designing its path, more than they care about the money they get for that. But I also then tie pay to performance and to results. I want everybody to understand that an idea that makes money makes them more money. an effort that makes more money makes them more money. Rather than everybody here who's on salary or whatever gets their standard cost of living adjustment percentage. But it's not a high percentage, Gordon. If they want to make more money, I give them ways to make more money that's tied to the effort they do. And people like to do that. The other thing is, it sounds old, it sounds tired, but recognizing people's performance achievements publicly is huge. Everybody wants to be praised in public, whether they'll say it or not. Sometimes that's worth more than money. I always, always, always use the principle, I praise very publicly, I correct very privately. I never talk in a group about a mistake that was made unless it's something that serves the whole group for a lesson and more than one person in that group was part of the mistake. I'm very, very careful to safeguard the dignity of people. That works better than cash in so many different circumstances. Little things like that to give people an opportunity to be seen, to be recognized. I will also reward people who experimented with something and failed. Hey, Gordon had a great idea. We ran it out. We ran it out hard. It didn't work, but I love his persistence, his tenacity. I want you to know that he worked 20 extra hours a month on this project for 6 months, and he is a hustler. And I want you to recognize Gordon as somebody who's a hustler at our company. Things like that cost me no money. But every executive listening to your podcast needs to recognize that the most valuable thing you have in your possession right now is your words. What you say and who you say it to matters. Everything. And if you are very diligent about the way you use those words about your employees and to your employees, you will return an investment on that that you can't possibly imagine. That and tie pay to performance. Every single time. Write it in your handbook. You don't have to worry then later about getting sued or, and maybe you do, but defend that shit. Sorry. Like, you it's can blurt fine. That it's, out.
You can curse on this podcast. It's
defend
all right.
Defend yeah. it. Like, I'm tired of people saying that, oh, because they're, you know, this position won, everybody gets this. Put it in your handbook. We pay based on merit here. And if you do well, you're going to get paid more. And these are the metrics that we're going to measure that by. And they can be whatever metrics you create. And apply them consistently to everyone and stand by that. And when you do that, you create the kind of people who want to work in that environment. I will tell you this, A players want to play with A players. C players do not want to play with A players because they feel like they have to work more than they want to. And A players will leave your company if you make them play with a bunch of C players.
Yeah, I think that's tremendous advice. How do you go about identifying who those A and those C players are? I know for our team, we've been trying to pair people up on a variety of sections of the team to try to really boost high performing teams and trying to put them on great projects. Mm-hmm. How do you go about the process of kind of identifying who your A and who your C players are?
Starts at your interview. Ask questions that are offbeat. Just because somebody graduated top of their class does not mean they're an A player. The days of using metrics that can come to you on two sheets of 9x11 paper are over. They are. You got to get the things you can't teach, and nobody can tell you about that. And if they write it on there and they tell you I'm a hardworking individual, you better see that. And if you don't see that, it's not real. Spend time with people in the interview process. Ask them questions that are not illegal. Don't ask them if they're married or, you know what I mean? I'm not, I am a lawyer. I understand. Everybody says, you know, like, can you ask that? And I'm like, I don't know. I do. And I figure as long as I'm consistent across all people, then no one can say I was singling them out. I do want to know, where'd you come from? What do you do on the weekends? What motivates you? What time do you get up in the morning? I have questions I ask people that tell me exactly who they are. Somebody who tells me they have a hard time making it out of bed before noon and then, you know, whatever. I'm like, okay, cool. Like, how late do you stay awake? There are people who say, I do my most amazing work between 11 p.m. and 2 a.m. I'm not that person, but okay, I'm willing to hear that. I look for things like that. I'm not interested in all the things I can teach. Like I said, I'm asking questions at the interview to know whether you hustle. I'm very interested in whether somebody had a job while they were a college student. I know this sounds terrible, but when somebody says I didn't work in high school or college because my dad didn't want me to have any stress, that for me, I know your dad had the best intentions, but for me as an employer, that's something I'm going to dig into a little bit, right? because maybe your dad didn't set you up to be a person to figure out how to multitask, how to prioritize your time, and how to keep grinding. Then when they're here, I will say this too, another unpopular thought. You have to hire very slowly and you have to fire very quick. You cannot imagine the negative impact of keeping somebody who's on the C squad with your A squad for too long. And that's all I'm going to say about that. I get that that's wrought with legal challenges. Again, I apply these rules pretty evenly and consistently. And I think everybody knows my stance. I'm a deeply caring person. But the thing I care most about is the good of the order, the good of the whole. I have people who are coming to work here every day, working really, really hard, sealing envelopes and mailing out invoices or doing things like that. They're making their kids' next braces payment. If you are costing us money and you're not contributing to everything going well, then you got to leave, not just for me, but for them. And that's the view that I have to hold. Nobody but the executive at the top can hold that. And you can't let that down.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more on the whole that you're failing your team more than you're failing the executive or the bottom line, because the person who's holding up that person that's not doing their fair share is the team members around them. And that could be someone who's very low level on the team is doing 40% more work every single day and stressed to the hilt to hold up the work of an individual that's on a team or even a lower level executive that's on the team that's not doing their fair share of work. So one of the things that we'd like to do our share of work is we love to get into the final four. And that's kind of one last little wrap up of understanding a little bit more about you, how you see the world, and then kind of, you know, how we can go forward and maybe address some of those issues in our own careers and our old in our own worldview. So our first question, we love this one, is 10 years from now, what do you think is going to have changed the most about the industrial business in general?
I think 10 years from now, we can't underestimate the presence and the power of technology. And so I will go further to say that if I was looking at how to prepare myself to be an employee in that and to be an employer, I would be looking to create an environment where people who understood how to work with tech felt incentivized to come be at my company. Tech meaning they make machines now that screw, and they have for a while, screw the lids on jars. They make machines that put boxes together, you know, like... So people who know how to service those machines, how to run those machines, things like that, I want to be a creative employer for them. But there are also things that we must not overlook. 10 years from now, you're still going to need a good plumber, no matter what. And so we have to hold that in balance. Revolutionizing ourselves, moving forward, coming to the state of the art technology in places we can, but not forgetting that by my estimation, people still want a human being to show up and unclog their toilet when it's time. And when they have a problem with a product they receive from me, even if a robot put that in a box, I want them to have a human being when they call to address that. You have to do a little bit of both.
Like, there's never a person so desperate as someone who's found out that their toilet's clogged. So, 100%. In terms of one of the things that we're desperate for, in life is often when we're starting off in life, we have no idea the path forward and we're seeking guidance. And we always like to ask a question about kind of how we would have potentially changed something going back in our life, or, you know, maybe some advice to our young self. And so I'm curious, could you give a little bit of advice to your young self when you're maybe 18 and kind of starting off in life?
I think, I would have told myself to be sure to know that not every voice gets the same amount of weight at the table. Not everybody gets to speak into your inner circle and into your inner sanctum. And it's okay to be discerning about those kinds of people. I would also tell my younger self that the best advice you'll ever get in life is from people who have no skin in the game and the outcome. Early on, I took banking advice from any banker who would talk to me. Now I look back on that and go, they had an angle, right? Like, but I didn't know any better, you know? Like, and so I think, and no disrespect to bankers, because now a bunch of them are my friends and things like that. But I, Never, 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 never underestimate the value of somebody giving you advice that doesn't have any skin in your game. It's probably pretty good advice.
So some of the ways that you can get advice for somebody who might not have a whole lot of skin in your game is through books. Yeah. And I'm curious, is there a book that you would recommend to our listeners?
I read a lot. I will tell you that what I read a lot of is biographies and autobiographies. And so I really love The Snowball by Warren Buffett, or about Warren Buffett. He didn't write it, and I'm failing the person who did. I also think I liked Stephen Schwartzman's book. I like The Ride of a Lifetime, Bob Iger. I was a history major in college, so I read all of the presidential biographies, autobiographies. I think you'll learn more from people who just tell what happened than you will from people tell you how to do something. My experience with people telling you how to do something is that they haven't usually done it, or they haven't done it the way you need to do it. And they're not as quick to say, these are all the mistakes I made. If you read a really, truly good biography or autobiography, you will see that no one's path to success was without a ton of hiccups, and a lot of those hiccups their own making. And I think people who can be really honest about, this is how I screwed it up and this is how I came out of it, will teach you more than you can learn anywhere else.
So one of the ways that we like to learn more than, maybe not anywhere else, but at least a decent amount, is we designed this podcast around reaching out to interesting people in the world of business, in real estate, and you know, logistics, and to try to learn a little bit more about our world. And we find that some of the best recommendations always come from individuals who are in the arena. And so I'm curious, who's the next person we should have on the podcast?
Oh my gosh.
And we won't let you get out of this question. This
is like a... You know, this sounds crazy, but I want to say that the next person who should be on this podcast is like somebody who's like a tattoo artist or something like that. Right. This is the thing that interests me the most right now. And maybe it's the podcast I'd like to listen to. In fact, I kind of want to interview my own tattoo artist. Here's why. This is a person who is a creative and wants to make art and is making permanent art on a human body and monetizes that. How cool is that? Like, what a cool business model. And they're typically people who are, they're very right-brained in the sense that they're very creative and they're putting their hands to something that has to generate revenue. I think it'd be a fascinating podcast guest, because the truth of the matter is they're making a decent living, you know?
Yeah, I think it would be. And I know that we were exploring, and we've been going on and off. We haven't been able to schedule with one of the largest graffiti artists in the Miami area, and kind of how that they've created culturally unique neighborhoods. And we just haven't been able to arrange it for a variety of reasons. I'm not sure they want to go about talking publicly on the podcast. But I think artists and those who create culture, be it on someone's body or on buildings, do serve really unique roles in our society, and they do drive a lot of value that we don't always put down to an easy number. So in terms of that, you don't have to give out your phone number, but we do want to go about allowing someone to reach out to you in the future. If they're interested in learning more, what's the best way to get in contact with you?
I have a website. It's megangluth.com. So just my name.com. I always leave this disclaimer. Do not send me a LinkedIn message. That inbox is bad. I can barely handle my actual email, right? So people email me there and I feel terrible, because like 6 months later, I'm like, hey, thanks for your kind words. Like, but here's the thing. I really do want to interact with people and I really do want to engage. I just can't do it there. So come to my website. There's a place to hit contact me. I actually get those. And I have a team of people that help me field those. And so it's a much better way to get a hold of me.
Megan, thank you so much for hopping on the podcast, and we have to have you on in the future.
Thanks so much, Gordon.
Thanks again to Megan. We appreciate her insights. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a 5-star rating, and a review. Your comments, interactions, and subscriptions truly matter and help us continue to provide quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lamphere with the Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.